Thank you, Stefan and Neil, for organizing this workshop. I'm glad to be here. So as Stefan said, I'll be talking about an emergent bouncing cosmology from quantum gravity condensates. And this is work that I did with Daniele Riti and Lorenzo Sindoni, also building on earlier work that Stefan did. So my goal today is to extract cosmology from a full theory of quantum gravity. And in particular, I'll be focusing on loop quantum gravity today. Now, we've already heard about loop quantum cosmology, where what you do is that you impose the symmetries that you're interested in before quantizing, and then use the techniques of LQG and try and mimic the LQG quantization on these symmetry-reduced so-called mini-superspace models that correspond to the homogeneous spacetimes that we're interested in. And this has been very successful, and I think it's given us a lot of potentially important insights into how to handle cosmology in full quantum gravity. That being said, the exact relation between loop quantum cosmology and full loop quantum gravity remains unclear, and so I think it's very important to try and go beyond loop quantum cosmology, of course, using any hints that LQC can offer us along the way. So let me give you a very brief introduction to at least the elements of LQG that I'll be using in this talk. And as I think everyone here knows, this is a background independent approach to quantum gravity, which is based on connection and triad variables, and a convenient basis for states in the canonical framework are what are known as spin networks. And these are just graphs, something that looks like this, where you have spins on the edges and intertwiners living on the nodes. And one of the very important results, which Abhay already mentioned this morning, is that if you look at geometrical observables, like the volume or the area, they have a discrete spectrum. And in fact, you can actually think of this spin network state as being a collection of polyhedra, where each polyhedron lives at one spin network node like this. So it has some volume living at the node, and it has some areas which are transverse to the links leaving from that node. So for example, if you take this node here in this picture, you'd have something that looks like a tetrahedron. And so in this heuristic sense, you can think of a spin network as being composed of these atoms of geometry, these spin network nodes that are all connected together. And so what I'd like to do now is to try and understand how, from a theory like LQG, which predicts that your spacetime is constituted of many Planck scale quantum geometry, what a cosmological spacetime would look like. And so the first point is that we should expect there to be many such quanta, because our observed universe is much larger than the Planck scale. We should also expect that each quantum of geometry contributes a small fraction of this total spatial volume, and that the cosmological expansion is primarily due to quantum geometry being added. So let me just say a little bit more about this last point. So you could think of cosmological expansion as occurring through two different processes, or a combination of them. So first, you can increase the number of quantum geometry, keeping the volume of each quantum fixed. Or you can increase the volume of each of your already existing quanta of geometry. So these are two possibilities. But if we keep in mind that the universe has expanded by a factor of at least 10 to the 28, if we start off with an original discreteness scale, which is the Planck scale, then the discreteness scale today should be at least 10 to the minus 7 meters, which we would expect to see some trace of in particle physics. And of course, we don't. So since we don't see this, this, at least to me, strongly suggests that the first possibility is the dominant process, so that as the universe expands, this is due to the number of quantum geometry increasing rather than the volume of the individual quanta increasing. Of course. But what I'm saying here is that we expect the first one to be at least the dominant process. Yeah. I certainly agree that this can play some role also. Yeah. OK, so that was just on that last point here. And I earlier mentioned that, you know, as we go along trying to understand how to get cosmology from full quantum gravity, it's good to see if there are any hints from loop quantum cosmology that we can use. And one of the key hints, in my opinion, is that LQC and its construction suggests that all n quantum geometry at some time are in fact in the same state, which correspond to the minimal excitation of geometry. And so if you want to know what the total spatial volume is, it's essentially the number of excitations you have times the minimal volume of this excitation. So let me say a little bit more about this. I already covered this a little bit this morning, so I'll go quickly here. But one of the key steps in constructing loop quantum cosmology is to define what the field strength operator is. And since our basic variables in the quantum theory are holonomies of the Ashgar-Rivero connection, the most natural thing to do is to express the field strength as the holonomy of this connection around a small loop of some area, which I denote by this. And this will give us our field strength operator. And of course, in lattice gauge theories, then we'd want to take the limit of this area going to zero. But we don't want to do this in LQC precisely because we have a discrete spectrum of the area operator in loop quantum gravity. So instead, what we do is we decide to represent the field strength by taking the holonomy of the connection around a plaquette, which corresponds to the minimal area in loop quantum gravity. And heuristically, you can understand this as assuming that the dominant contribution to the area of some surface comes from many, many, many of these minimal area excitations. So if you want to know what the field strength is at a point, or as close to a point as you can get, then you want to consider one of these minimal excitations like this. Okay. And so if we take this picture seriously now, an important point is that all these minimal area excitations are identical. And so this suggests that if we're interested in a cosmological space-time, then LQC is hinting that perhaps we're interested in states with many excitations that are all in the same state. And this is precisely a condensate state, and in this case, it's a condensate of geometry. So coming from loop quantum cosmology, this suggests that perhaps we should be looking at condensate states if we're interested in cosmological spacetimes. And if we want to work with condensate states, then this directly leads us to group field theory, which is essentially just rewriting loop quantum gravity in a field theory language. And the reason why this is convenient is just because when we're working with condensate states, of course, it's very convenient to have creation annihilation operators. And this is what group field theory does. It gives us these creation annihilation operators for our quantum geometry. Okay. So with this background, let me try to give a brief overview of what I'll do in the remainder of the talk now. So the key idea that I'm following is that we have some continuous cosmological spacetime which will emerge from coarse graining a group field theory condensate state. So I have some microscopic theory, a group field theory. I have some state there, and then I look at some collective observables and I see how they behave. And because my group field theory has some microscopic dynamics, I can evaluate these on the condensate state that I'm interested in. And these will imply some effective coarse-grained Friedmann equations. So for example, I just find out what my total spatial volume is in this condensate state, and I calculate the dynamics of this spatial volume for this state as determined by my GFT theory. And this, of course, will have to come out with respect to some relational time. And finally, just one quick comment. Here, I'm going to make an assumption on the type of LQG or GFT state that I'm interested in, which I believe is relevant for cosmology. So I'm going to consider a very specific type of state. But the GFT theory itself is a candidate theory for quantum gravity, which should be applicable for any space-time or any state that we're interested in. So if we're interested in black holes, we'd use the same theory, just look at a different type of state. All right? Any questions so far? OK, so let me get into more of the details. So first, I'm going to start by explaining in a little bit more what group field theory is. Then I'll explain what condensate states I'm interested in, and from them, extract the effective Friedmann equations that follow. OK, so you can Think of group field theory as being a second quantized language for loop quantum gravity, where you have some field operators here, which create and annihilate the quantum geometry that we're interested in, which are spin network nodes. So you have some creation operator here, you have some annihilation operator, and they have all these labels, which label the spin network node here. So we have the J's and the M's, which color each of the links of the four valent spin network nodes. And we have an intertwiner and a scalar field phi here, which live on the spin network nodes. And this scalar field phi here represents some matter field. And it's not to be confused with the group field var phi. So the var phi and the phi are different quantities here. Now, your creation annihilation operators have the standard commutation relations that you know. They're simply deltas between all of the arguments. And we have a Fock vacuum, which is the no space state. And this is a state where there are no excitations of geometry whatsoever, and so it has zero volume. So in particular, if you're interested in Minkowski space is very highly excited with respect to this vacuum.
So the label of little phi for this creation relation operator is like a relational time variable or something else? Like
so here it's just a matter field, but I will use it as a relational time variable later, yes. Okay. Now, the creation operators will create disconnected quantum geometry. So they'll create spin network nodes, which are completely disconnected from any other spin network nodes that already exist in the state. And then, since you want to create a graph in loop quantum gravity, you want to impose connectivity in some way. And this can be done by imposing projectors that act on the links of the spin network nodes that you want to connect with each other. And finally, your GFT has some dynamics, which are governed by its action. And this action is typically chosen so that if you look at its partition function and take the perturbative expansion of this, this will give you exactly the sum over geometries of a spin foam model. So here, I'm going to start with the simplest case possible. And so I'm going to look at gravity coupled to a massless scalar field. Then the dominant terms in the action are the following. The main point to keep in mind here is that there's a kinetic term. There's a part here which does not depend on the matter field. And then there's a part that does depend on the matter field through this partial derivative squared. And then there's some interaction term here, which I assume is just some phi to the fifth term. And this is because we're assuming simplicial gravity. But you can include higher order terms here as well without any problems. But just for simplicity, I'm going to focus on this action here. OK, so this is the group field theory that I'll be looking at. Now, one last slide. So the operators that we're interested in are like those that you know from quantum field theory. So for example, you have some number operator. And this is simply acting with phi dagger phi and then summing over all of the labels. Now, precisely because we have a continuous label corresponding to the matter field, now this comes to Abhay's question, we can now use this matter field as a relational clock. And so I can ask, for example, what is this number operator evaluated at some instant phi naught? And all that means is that now instead of integrating over phi, I just sum over the geometrical labels rather than the geometrical and matter labels. Yes?
On the previous transparency, where does one see these projectors?
So these projectors act on the state. Right, so you construct a state, and then you'll act the projectors on that state to then have a connected graph. So the action doesn't know about that. Yeah?
You don't have to answer this question. It might be a wrong question. But the high order terms, is there some kind of effective field theory way of seeing why those terms might be irrelevant so that you can connect this to the spin network language?
So there are two different types of higher order terms here. There's one in the kinetic term. Here. And here you'll have higher order terms in the derivatives of your matter field. And these will be suppressed by the Planck scale.
Yeah. So that's.
And then here, this is because I'm looking at simplicial gravity. If I go beyond simplicial gravity, if I consider spin network nodes with, say, five valent vertices or six or so on, then I'll expect there to be higher order terms here. But here I'm just going to concern myself with simplicial gravity, and that truncates that there. Yeah.
So in this action, I mean, the. You only see the scalar field phi. I mean, we don't see the.
Right, I'm hiding everything in this K2 and this V5. Yes, it's very complicated, yeah. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay.
If you take the continuous limit, and in the previous, you were saying that this interaction term will become of a very high order, so it should go to zero, right?
Sorry, I missed.
So this term, the interaction term, yeah. You are saying that it depends on the fact that you are considering a simplicial geometry, but if you were, for instance, taking a standard decomposition and using, I don't know, polyhedra of higher valence, mm-hmm. then this term will become of higher order, and then mm-hmm. it should become more and more suppressed, right?
In some settings, I would expect so, yeah. I'm not sure how generally I'd be willing to say that it's suppressed, but certainly in some cases it will be. Okay. Yeah, I'd have to look at that more carefully and try and quantify it. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Right, and so then the operators that we're interested in are just the ones that you're used to from field theory, except now with different labels. So your number operator is phi dag phi, and because we have a matter field, we can introduce relational operators like this. Okay. And so that's the theory that I'm working with. Now I'll start talking about the condensate states that I'll be constructing to represent cosmological spacetimes. And the simplest type of condensate states that you can think of are the Grossi-Tezzi condensate states, and these are just coherent states of your GFT field operator. So you just act with your creation operator on the Fock vacuum in some exponential, and you weight it with the sigma, which is known as the condensate wave function.
Setting
the phase to zero here. Yeah. So, and again, what's important is that your massive scalar field can be used as a relational clock. So I can think of this quantity as being the condensate wave function evaluated at an instant of relational time, phi naught. And so now I can have my quantum equations of motion coming from my GFT, find out what they tell me about this condensate state sigma, and this will give me some relational dynamics for my condensate wave function with respect to my matter field. And this is how my dynamics will come out. Okay, now before going any further, it's important that we make some choices about what our condensate state should look like, and in particular, to make choices for our condensate wave function. And in particular, we want to try and make choices so that the equations of motion will be as simple to solve as possible. So what are some of these choices that we'll make? So the first one is that for simplicity, we're really going to start with the simplest case that we can think of, which is a spatially flat FLRW spacetime. And so what we do first is that we're going to neglect the connectivity between our quantum geometry, the spin network nodes. So we're only going to worry about how many we have and the properties of them, not how they're connected to each other. And this is reasonable as a first approximation here, because the main observable that we're interested in is the total spatial volume. And for this, we don't need to know how they're connected together. Furthermore, because the spacetime is spatially flat, we don't have to worry about encoding spatial curvature in the connectivity of the graph. So for these two reasons, we'll neglect connectivity, and this will make the state much easier to handle. Also, we're only interested in isotropic observables because we're interested in a spacetime which is isotropic. And so we'll restrict our attention to equilateral or isotropic configurations. And what this means is that we're looking at spin network nodes where all the J's are the same, and we ask that the volume be the maximal volume possible. This would correspond to a tetrahedron, which is as equilateral as possible in the quantum theory. And just as a side note, this assumption can also be motivated by LQC, since the minimal excitations of geometry that we have an isotropic configuration. But here we're doing something a little bit more general. So this is still a condensate wave function like this is still slightly more general than what you'd expect coming directly from LQC. Yes?
So
kind of interesting that that's kind of what happens in superfluid helium-3.
Yeah, I'm
configurations are completely balanced.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's a link to be made there. I'd be interested in...
That's the gross Kutiyevsky equation.
Right.
For that S-wave, it's exactly that state.
Yeah.
There's a nice picture of an X-ray where you see actually the superfluid actually form in a tetrahedron that's balanced.
Okay.
It's a coincidence.
Yeah, nice. Okay. So now we want to look at the dynamics for our state, so we can extract the large-scale dynamics for the cosmology. And the quantum equations of motion are simply that we ask that the operator value, the operator version of the classical equations of motion be satisfied for the state. But one thing to keep in mind is that when you work with condensate states, you're always working in an approximation. So the condensate state is an approximate solution to the quantum equations of motion. So asking this for our condensate state is too much. So we'll ask for a little bit less, and this is, we'll ask that the first Schrödinger Dyson equation be satisfied. And what we expect now is that the higher order Dyson equations should approximately be satisfied. So they won't give exactly zero, but something small. And so if I look at the GFT action that I showed earlier, this gives the nonlinear equations of motion for the condensate wave function, which you see here. And there are these numerical parameters that show up here, the mj and the wj, and these depend on the form of the parameters in the GFT action. So you have something which is very complicated, but then when you evaluate it on a condensate state of this type, it boils down to these constants, one for each j. And you have this equation of motion, of course, for each j. Okay. Now, before going on, something that's important to keep in mind is that the Gross-Witewski constant approximation is typically most trustworthy when the interactions are small. So to start with, we're really going to focus on the regime where the interaction term is negligible. And if we want to go and start looking at cases when the interaction term becomes important, it's not clear. Sometimes the Gross-Witewski approximation continues to hold, but sometimes it doesn't. So just to be safe here, we're going to really focus on the case where the interaction term is negligible. And as you can see, if we just go back here, this interaction term, the nonlinear term, becomes large when the norm of sigma j becomes sufficiently large. And this is the large volume limit, as we'll see a little bit later. And so we expect the Gross-Witewski approximation to be most trustworthy at small volumes. At large volumes, it may be important to start talking about connectivity. This is how you'd include the interactions. So in the remainder of my talk, I'm going to focus on the mesoscopic regime, where on the one hand, the Gross-Witewski approximation is most trustworthy, so a small norm of sigma j, and where there's still nonetheless enough quanta for a continuum space-time interpretation to be viable. So we want sigma j to be sufficiently large. So we want something in this in-between region. And this is what I'll be looking at for the remainder.
In the earlier part of the talk, you said that ignoring connectivity because you wanted to have flat or something. But now you're bringing another point up here, right, which is really this approximation itself not being good. So therefore,
What this is suggesting to me, now again, I want to stress that in some cases, the Gross-Witewski approximation continues to hold even when the interactions become large. This is something which you really have to check on a case-by-case basis, and we haven't been able to check that here yet. So we're not sure. Now that being said, if it does fail here, what that would tell me is that I was a bit too naive in neglecting connectivity earlier. That's the lesson I would take. Okay, so working in this regime, I'll rewrite my condensate wave function in terms of its norm and its phase. And I find that the equations of motion imply that for each j, I had these two conserved quantities, ej and qj. And these are conserved with respect to my relational time corresponding to the matter field. And there's one remaining non-trivial equation of motion for each j, which is the following. And what you see is that this is a very simple ODE, and you can clearly see that this is a particle in a central potential, and this rho j will never become zero because you have this divergent repulsive potential at rho j is equal to zero. and this will be important later. Okay, so this is the microscopic dynamics of my state. Now I want to start extracting cosmology from it. And so for this, I need to relate cosmological variables I'm interested in to the appropriate GFT observables. And so specifically the volume. And this you can really think of as being the analogous of the energy operator in QFT, right? You just have some phi dag or phi and weighted by the energy of the quanta. Here, instead of weighting by the energy, you're weighting by the volume. But it's exactly the same construction. And for this condensate state, you get this simple form here. And Vj here is essentially j to the 3/2 times the Planck volume. So Vj is just a constant. The form of the momentum of the massive scalar field is a little bit more complicated. But at the end of the day, you see that it's just a sum over the Qjs, which are the conserved quantities that I showed you a few, just the last slide, I think. And so immediately, you see that the momentum of a massive scalar field is preserved in time as a constant of the motion. And this is precisely the continuity equation for a Friedmann spacetime with a massive scalar field. So we've already recovered the continuity equation in this context. So let's go on and look at the Friedmann equation. And recall that the volume here is given by this relationship here. So if I'm interested in the Friedmann equation, I want to ask, how is this volume changing with respect to my relational time phi? Vj is just a constant. And so my time derivative of the volume has this simple form. And I can calculate this Hubble rate in terms of my relational clock. And it gives me the following result here. Now, if you're interested in the low curvature semi-classical limit, which is the large volume limit, now remember that if you're interested in large volume, that corresponds to large rho j. So that means that under this square root, this term dominates. These two terms drop out in this semi-classical limit. And then you can see that the numerator and the denominator cancel out if mj squared is equal to some constant. And if you want to get the correct Friedmann equation, you have to ask that mj squared is equal to 3 pi g. Now,
did you restrict yourself to small volumes in ignoring the?
Right, so I'm hoping that in my mesoscopic regime, I can still take this limit where this term dominates. Yeah. If not, then I'm stuck in some small volume regime where quantum effects are always important, and then I won't necessarily have a good, well, I won't see the classical limit yet. For that, I would have to go beyond this regime. But if within the regime, I can already go to some situation where this term dominates, then that's good enough. Okay, and I should point out here that this condition is, of course, sufficient, but it's not necessary. All you need to have, really, is to have one j dominate in this sum, and the mj for that j to have this form. And then you'll get the correct class sum. This is something that Stefan has worked on. Okay, so what we see is that we have some emergent Friedmann equation, and it has the correct classical limit. Just a quick word. You're probably used to seeing h squared is equal to 8 pi g over 3 times the energy density. That's, of course, in proper time. Here I'm working in relational time where I'm using my massive scalar field. And when you use that as a clock variable, then this is your classical Friedmann equation. Okay, but now we're interested in what happens in the quantum regime. And recall that we had this equation of motion for rho j. And that rho j never becomes zero because of the repulsive potential at rho j is equal to zero. And you can see that because your volume is just the sum of these rho j squareds weighted by some volume, that the volume can never be zero, right? So if your rho j is never zero, then clearly your volume is never zero. And so the Big Bang and Big Crunch singularities are generically resolved. And what's more, you can easily check that since rho j will bounce once for each j, that your singularity will be replaced by a bounce. Okay. Now, let me go on and try and connect this a little bit more to loop quantum cosmology.
Sorry.
Yes.
So different j's bounce at different times?
In principle, they could. It depends how you set up your initial state.
So
you could set it up so they all bounce simultaneously, of course, but you don't have to.
I guess I'm just saying if you start with a classical space-time, would you end up with a classical space-time or not?
Yes, so if you go sufficiently far, you will.
Okay, because they all bounce at
some time. They'll all bounce at some finite time. Mm-hmm. So if you go far enough, if they all hit the bounce and you go far enough away, then you'll be back. Some classical.
Can you remind us what rho j are?
Rho j is the norm of my Condorcet wave function.
What are the different j's? What do the different j's represent?
So here, I was looking at Condorcet states which have these equilateral configurations. So I have a Condorcet wave function for each j. So these are half integers, right? And it turns out that their dynamics decouple completely for the type of state that I'm looking at. This is not true in general, but for the type of state I'm looking at, they decouple. And then I can solve it j by j.
What is rho j is a question?
Rho j is the norm of sigma j. So here I rewrite sigma j as rho j e to the
I. Theta.
So in the emergent space-time, I would say that this is probably the clearest one you'll get, that it tells you how much volume comes in that j.
So it's the volume due to a certain spin.
Exactly, yeah. So this vj here is j to the 3/2 times the Planck volume, and this will tell you essentially, quote unquote, how many quanta like that you have. Yeah. Francesca, do you have a question? No.
Can you explain again? Because you had some equations from which you got classical Friedman equation.
Yes.
And you also got a MOPS. So what is different between the two?
Okay, so this is my equation, right? And this is just true in general. Now what I do is I look at the large rho j case, and then I get this. Then I can also ask what happens away from that. And it's not so transparent because in this case, because I'm summing over all the j's here, so it's a little messy. But if you look at it j by j, it's a little bit clearer. So this is still true at the bounce as well. But I think it's just much more direct to see it here when you look at the equation of motion j by j. And then you clearly see that each rho j will bounce. And so then it follows that your volume has to bounce as well.
So when you go to the very high j, does it mean that basically you have one condensate that corresponds just to a single quanta that is as big as the whole universe?
Yeah, so if you can choose, you can certainly choose a state with support on rho j, which is where j is very large. So you can choose whatever state you want. Yeah. Then this...
But isn't this limit exactly that limit?
No, because no.
J.
So this is large rho j.
Okay.
Yeah. So large j will be a different limit, and it won't give you this. No, that'll be something else.
Yeah. Just a question about the picture. So I might just think that I have like these plaquettes that are disconnected, and they all fall into the same quantum state, just like how I have many bosons, right? You have spin one indistinguishable particles, but they form the same. So therefore, in that case, all of those bosons acquire the same phase information.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Do these plaquettes have all independent phases?
I mean, this here, as I said earlier, I think, here they all have the same Condorcet wave function, and here I've just set the phase to zero.
But they don't have random phases?
No, here they'll all have the same phase, the same vanishing phase.
Making the condensate by demanding that.
By demanding.
Yeah. Yeah.
The wave function is complex, right? So it has a phase.
Yeah.
I guess I was talking
So I think maybe you're asking how the condensation itself occurs?
No,
okay.
I was just saying that, you know, that's why if I have a, the usual squeeze with a user to.
Yeah. So so here.
The wave function. Yeah. All each independent particle wave states have independent phases. Mm-hmm. When they all get the same phase, they fall into this.
Right. So here, here they all have that same. Okay. Like in this case, I just set to zero, but yeah. Any other questions?
But it's related to this in the sense that there is not a dynamical mechanism that does that all the species should have a certain value in a given regime.
No, so I would like there to be. I would like to say like we can see this dynamically condensing, but we don't have that yet. Here we're just saying let's assume that we have a constant state, and then what happens?
But you can get it from spin-form models.
Well, that would be great.
I can tell you.
Yes, please tell me that. That would be nice if we could show how this emerges dynamically. That would be.
I'm thinking of some results by Muxin Han showing that the more you go towards the singularity, the more the spin form amplitude is dominated by small spins.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe
it would be nice to see if that could be combined.
This feature,
yeah.
If you use it.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so what we've seen is that looking at the hydrodynamics of our constant state, we recover the continuity equation, and we recover some Friedmann equation, which in the large volume limit reduces to the classical one, and that also gives a bounce. Now, at the very beginning, I used LQC to motivate the type of state that we were interested in. So let me go back there. Now, following the motivation that I gave earlier, that would suggest that the appropriate constant state, if we really wanted to recover LQC as much as possible, is one where all of the quanta are equilateral spin network nodes with J is equal to 1/2. So motivated by this observation, I'm going to consider the case where my constant wave function only has support on 1J, which is J naught. Now, in LQC, this J naught would be 1/2, but I'll still keep it a little bit more general. But now instead of allowing some superposition over all J's from 1/2, 1 up to whatever, I'll restrict it to just a single J naught. And what you can see is that now your sums here will trivialize and you'll have a simpler Friedmann equation. And what you find is the following. You get this, you get the Hubble rate squared is equal to the classical term with this extra correction. And what's interesting is that this correction is exactly the one that you get in loop quantum cosmology. So we find that if we choose a constant state which looks like what you would be motivated to choose coming from loop quantum cosmology, you recover almost exactly the LQC effect of dynamics up to this extra term that shows up here. So this is a term that you don't see in loop quantum cosmology. So if I remove this term, this is exactly the LQC effective equation. Now you have this new extra term which depends on this constant EJ naught coming from the GFT action. And so all that I have to say about this is that this term clearly contributes to the dynamics of the condensate, but its geometric interpretation in the emergent spacetime is very unclear. Yes?
Could it be something related to a cosmological
constant? No, because it doesn't scale properly with the volume here. Yeah, we looked into that. Unfortunately, it doesn't fit. Yeah.
But this term was exactly the term we were talking about before. Isn't coming from this interaction term that you are.
So this term comes from here. So this is still coming from the linear part.
Okay.
It's essentially, yeah. I don't have a good intuition for it. I mean, if dynamically, it's clear what it does, but geometrically, I really don't see what it.
Can we cast in terms of A or Hubble?
So what you can do is you can say, okay, you have this contribution here. Can I view this as some effective perfect fluid? And the answer is yes. And then it looks like some ekparotic perfect fluid.
Oh.
But that's all I can say.
So
yeah.
That's a stiff equation of state.
Like yeah.
Superficially, it looks like this term would prevent
a bounce. No, because here I didn't show you the v dependence here. This goes like 1 over v squared. So this term here wins, right? So yeah. So this energy density goes to 1 over v squared. Yeah. So what it will do is it'll change the energy scale at which the bounce happens if it's very large, but it won't prevent the bounce.
Hey, Rob, real quick. Remember the Kibble criterion where you had these different phases and stuff that were disconnected? Was there ever a situation that naturally sort of resolved? Like, you know, you have defects form because you have these disconnected regions, where that gets, you know, at some later time that goes away and you end up in a more homogenous situation.
I mean, causality always constrains the size of the
region, right.
So I think the answer is no.
Right. I was just thinking about the reverse. This seems like, there we go back to the discussion session.
Okay, so anyways, the main message from this slide is just that if you choose a constant state, which is strongly motivated by LQC, even more so than previous ones, you get a Friedmann equation, which is almost identical to the effect of LQC equation.
Is there an explanation for the minus sign in your framework? Why does the bounce term come within the minus sign?
Right, so what happens here is that you get this term here, gives you the minus sign.
And where did that come from?
So that comes this equation here.
Is it clearly a quantum effect? Can you say?
Yes, because it has to do with the phase of your wave function, of your constant wave function.
Is there really an h bar there, or?
Let me see, I think there is. Yes, because this is, your momentum has to be a classical quantity and there's an h bar here, so this one has to go, has to have some 1 over h bar dependence.
So the extra term saying goes like h bar, 1 over h bar.
So q has to go as 1 over h bar.
AC, the denominator, was blank density.
Where, sorry?
AC, next one.
Next one.
Epsilon C is proportional.
Oh yeah, so this is proportional to Planck density. Yes.
H goes to zero, that goes to infinity.
Yeah.
H goes to zero, you
have. Yeah. So in that way, it's similar to LQC. Now, this minus sign here
really
comes from this term here, and that is related to the phase of your constant wave function.
No.
This QJ term here.
Now, is it state dependent or is it?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. But so the QJ cannot be zero because if all your QJs are zero, then you're in Minkowski space and you don't have any contribution from your scalar field. But yes, you can choose your QJs to be whatever you want, so long as at least one of them is non-zero. Yeah.
Well, one last question. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, I know it's dangerous to push analogies too far, mm-hmm. but normally in the in the states, there are two representations that are dual to each other, right? There's the number representation and the phase representation. Mm-hmm. So is there an equivalent of this? So you definitely have this in terms of the, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the mathematical structure will be essentially identical. You just need to change what your fields are. Here, we're really looking at the volume as, you know, one of our quantities of interest. And this makes sense to be some weighted, you know, number representation, I guess, is what you'd call it. So you could look at the other one, but we haven't done that. But it should be there. I mean, mathematically, it's very, very similar. The whole.
It's just that they're both useful because they both give a different.
Right.
System.
Right. So far we've focused on this one,
right.
But the other one is certainly there. Yes. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. So let me end then. So. Motivated by some simple heuristic arguments combined with some insights from LQC, we made a specific ansatz on the type of state in LQG that corresponds to cosmological spacetimes, and these are GFT condensates. Now, the equations of motion for these constant states are determined by the GFT action, and the hydrodynamics of these give the continuity and Friedmann equations. We recover the classical Friedmann equations in an appropriate semi-classical limit, for some choices of parameters in the GFT action. So if you make appropriate choices for these parameters, then we recover the correct classical limit. And we also find that the classical singularity is resolved and generically replaced by a bounce. And what's nice is that the LQC effective Friedmann equations are almost recovered for natural choice of the constant wave function. Now, this being said, there's still a huge number of open questions. And so first, it would be nice to study other types of condensate wave functions and GFT actions to better understand the details of the semi-classical regime at late times. Here, I was really looking at a massive scalar field, so we'd like to add scalar fields with some non-vanishing potentials or to consider other types of matter fields. We've been looking at the equations of motion generated by the first Schwinger-Dyson equation, so it'd be it's important to check the error in the higher order Schwinger-Dyson equations to make sure that the approximation holds. We'd also like to extend this to include spatial curvature and isotropies, perturbations. We'd also like to go on and study what happens when the interactions become large, as well as include the connectivity information analysis and understand the geometrical interpretation of this EJ term. So there's a whole laundry list of things that still remain to be done. So on that note, thank you for your attention.
Something there that we're not seeing or perhaps is hidden that you can actually get that state out of quantum gravity?
So,
because you give a very general framework in which you're summing all these spins and so on, doing an averaging.
So, in a sense, you can think of these states as being spin network nodes, sorry, spin network states in loop quantum gravity, where you just disregard the connections between all these nodes. So you take a big graph, spin network graph, and then you chop it up into pieces.
And you're not worried about intertwining the whole.
Yeah, you don't worry about the connectivity between them. And then we expect that GFT and LQG for given states should give the same dynamics. And so this really is then the LQG dynamics of a state where you're neglecting some information in the state that you're looking at. Because I went over this quickly, but let me just go back. So the GFT action, which I use to get the equations of motion, this is chosen so that if you look at its partition function, then you get spinful models that come out when you do the perturbative expansion of this. So this is a relationship to LQG. Now here I'm considering a type of state which, strictly speaking, isn't in the LQG Hilbert space because they're disconnected nodes.
It's connected to a graph.
Okay. Well.
It's in the Hilbert space. It's just that it is in the Hilbert space. No question.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But yeah.
Well, I think
you have an explicitly state. You haven't explicitly told us what that Hilbert space is. I guess disconnected graphs are allowed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, my mistake. Yeah.
The only thing that I mean, just to amplify on Zuma's question, that's a really nice question. One other thing that happens, for example, is that what is the relation between the full theory and kind of LQC? The superspace or some symmetry reduction approximation. So normally people sort of think of truncating the big theory. And that doesn't give you the right quantum theory. But what you have to do is to trace out all the other degrees of freedom. And as you know, in the paper we wrote, we showed that if you do LQC and you did Bianchi 1 model and traced out all anisotropies, then you get precise with the LQC Friedman model. Right? So I think some of this question can be rephrased like saying that, well, there must be some space in the full theory, and you're tracing over some degrees of freedom. So you're basically forgetting everything except one global degree of freedom, which is density or volume or something, over one.
Right.
And then I think if you traced all that, something like this could happen. But it would be very nice if, in fact, there is a rigorous result. And I think there is likely to be somebody gonna
say, I think so. I mean, the one thing here I'd add to that is that, yes, you're ignoring a lot of degrees of freedom. You're really focusing on the cosmological ones, but you're also looking at a very specific class of states.
But I think the trace operation, it might be that these states are...
Perhaps.
So I think that is the thing that one would like to understand better.
You know, it reminds me of Philip Anderson's take on spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is that it's more to do with the computational complexity of the state space rather than like that you have some field theory that picks some non-trivial vacuum that you have a many-body state, and then as the system gets more and more complex, the symmetry breaks.
No. So we're running quite late, so I would suggest postponing everything else to the discussion session and break for coffee, if that's fine. And let's thank Ed again.
All right, thank you.